Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is the Win Tracy recording at 2:11 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time. And today is, it is June 2nd, and it is Friday. So it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. There has been a lot of activity this week, and we'll get to all of it in due course. But I think the most important thing that's happening right now is that U.S. 10-year Treasuries are breaking down to a new reaction low, and that I think is something that we can put the rest of what is happening in stock markets in particular in context through. We can use that as a window through which to look at the rest of the market, because I think the bond market is beginning to conclude that the Fed might raise rates this month, and that's already in the price, but they're unlikely to go very much further. If the Fed is serious about attempting to reduce the size of its balance sheet, then their hands are largely tied. It is almost unconscionable that they are going to be able to raise interest rates while at the same time reducing the size of the balance sheet. The balance sheet's currently at $4.45 trillion, and there isn't any real evidence that they have tried to reduce the size of the balance sheet at any time in the last 22 years. So this would represent really quite a significant challenge. The only time that we have seen any real evidence of a central bank trying to reduce the size of their balance sheet has been the ECB between about 2012 and 2014. There was a massive debate going on in Europe at the time about what they should do. There was a number of hawks in the ECB were really rather scared that the swift creation of money over €1 trillion between 2011 and early 2012 was going to have a very sharp inflationary outcome, and that was completely the antithesis of what they had signed up for. So they prevailed, and they insisted that that money be taken back out of the system. It had some really very profound impacts. One was that the euro rallied quite significantly. When you take €1 trillion out of circulation, that represents a significant loss of supply without a corresponding loss in demand. So that pushed the currency up. But it also had a deflationary impact on quite a significant proportion of the eurozone economy. And they eventually had to reverse course, and we know what happened since. The size of the balance sheet has since doubled. In fact, the ECB's balance sheet is now larger in dollar terms than the Federal Reserve's. So then that is a significant challenge for the Fed. It is practically, I think, impossible for them to raise interest rates while also trying to reduce the size of the balance sheet. The ECB achieved $1 trillion in about a year, maybe a little bit more than 1 year. For the Federal Reserve to do the same thing, then it would have a deflationary impact. Considering that when we look at the global economy, and I think we do have to remember that monetary policy has been accommodative for much of the last decade, and most particularly since 2008, but prior to that, there isn't any great deal of evidence that the quantity of liquidity had been, there'd been any real concerted removal of liquidity from the global economy. $18.7 trillion is about where the combined assets on the balance sheets of the Federal Reserve, the ECB, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and the People's Bank of China, when aggregated in US dollars, that's about the total. So even though the Fed has been holding pat, and the Bank of England held pat for until about 2014 when they stopped reporting the figures, the aggregate figure remains in an uptrend. In fact, it's really quite a consistent uptrend. And that suggests that if money is both mobile and global, then the potential to for it to travel to the most attractive assets or the ones with the best yields, the best potential total return, is still unimpeded. And if the Federal Reserve, and I think what we're seeing now is that if the bond market is willing to bet by buying bonds, by the yield dropping down to new reaction lows, then in the absence of a clear upward dynamic on the yield, then we kind of have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside for the 10-year. The 30-year pulled back sharply yesterday and recouped the entire decline in here today. It's now trading above 100. Well, I think it is trading at closing at least at a new high. It is right in the region of the 200-day moving average. For a while today, it was trading above 155. It's at 154. Well, two ticks below 155 right now. A sustained move above the 200-day moving average would confirm a return to demand dominance beyond the short term, and this has been a substantial pullback. And investors have been conditioned over the course of what has been a significant 36-year bull market to buy the dips. The price has dipped, and therefore, there will certainly be people out there looking to buy the dip. If the bond market has concluded that the Fed is unlikely to raise rates again this year, or is unlikely to be aggressive in either reducing the size of its balance sheet or in raising rates, then that removes a source of anxiety. A great deal of debt needs to be refinanced in the years up to about 2022. There was a shed load of debt was taken out in the aftermath of the credit crisis and the European sovereign debt crisis. Hundreds of billions of dollars need to be refinanced in the years between 2018 and 2021. That's just for government paper. The Federal Reserve also owns a lot of mortgages, and that constitutes a substantial proportion of their balance sheet. And what it is they're going to do with those, I think, is perhaps the biggest question of all. And can they realistically sell them? Because, or more particularly, because they won't be selling them. It's about whether what they're going to do with them when they mature. Are they going to reinvest the principal? Because if they do not reinvest the principal, that robs the market of a source of demand. And in just the opposite way that in just the opposite way that the removing supply of euros contributed to euro strength, removing demand for bonds would result in bond weakness. And that's not great news for the consumer. That would represent higher mortgage rates, and that's not something that the Federal Reserve probably wants, unless, of course, they want to directly target the property market, considering that the US economy is primarily consumer-based, and a lot of family savings are tied up in the family home. That would be really a very dangerous move indeed. And the bond market, having, I think, understood what those risks are, have concluded that they're not going to do it, that they are going to be forced to be incredibly gradual in how they deal with these very difficult problems. The When we generally have a crash, it isn't usually because things get really out of hand on their own. They're usually helped along by central banks. Crashes usually result from policy mistakes, and raising interest rates in an aggressive manner when we have been in an environment where the stock market, and I think it is, we have to be broader than that and say the global financial markets have become addicted to liquidity, then that would be rather dangerous, and I think that would also represent a clear threat. If we are going to have lower yields, then there is the potential that stocks will again yield more than the 10-year treasury. The S&P 500 cleared the 2400 level this week. It has broken out in a rather dynamic manner, and it yields 1.95%. Now, the 10-year yields just a bit more than 2%, but its yield is coming down. So we may not be that far away from when stocks will yield more than bonds once more. And back in 2012, that was, I think, the last time that we had that condition. It was a substantial bullish factor for the stock market. When we look at the S&P 500, we're presented with really quite a consistent uptrend. And I think the easiest way to analyze it is from the perspective of attempting to describe the trend to a blind person. This is the I think the what we kind of drill into the delegates at the chart seminar, because a consistent trend should be easily identifiable. And this has been particularly consistent since the beginning of 2016. This reaction at the beginning of 2016 was about 120 points, and the next reaction was about 100 points. This one was both, and in fact, they both went on for about the same amount of time. The one at the beginning of this year was both shorter and had a narrower amplitude, but the most recent one was also about 100 points. So that's pretty consistent. It's actually one of the most consistent periods of time on the chart. The other really consistent period was between about 2012 and 2015, and that also coincided with a period of time when equities yielded more than bonds. It was also around the time when we had QE3 and the big run-up in the size of the Fed's balance sheet. It's the ECB's turn right now, and certainly that money is flowing all over the world to support bull markets just about everywhere. But if we then go and think about what are the filter questions that we can ask, because there are three things you can see in a chart. You can see what you want to see, and you can see what you think you're going to see, and you can see what's there. So we need to have these filter questions, and we ask ourselves a very simple question: is it trending or ranging? Is this a big bull market or a big bear market? It's clearly a big bull market. And what are the consistency characteristics? Well, for the last year and a half, it has been that it has ranged for a few months and broken out, and when it pulls back by around 100 points, and until it stops doing that, we would have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Then we'd ask another really simple question: is there any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend endings? And the answer is no. What we have is a short-term overbought condition relative to the trend mean. Now, if it were to pull back in a dynamic manner and pull all the way back to the mean, well, then that would represent a larger pullback. The moving average is at 200, 2,290, and the high over the last couple of days was at 2,440. So that would be a 150-point pullback. That would be a larger reaction than we have seen. And even then, that would probably only hold it up for a while longer, because it would need to sustain a move below the trend mean. If there isn't any great deal of evidence of trend ending, well, then we could potentially script what an ending might look like. If it pulled back very sharply and got right back to the moving average in a very short period of time, that would begin to constitute a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, but it wouldn't probably be big enough. It would have to pull back by substantially more than dropping below the 200 moving average to constitute a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. It could accelerate. Considering that we are already 8 years into a bull market, and the market is continuing to go up, and I think people are getting the message that this is a powerful bull market, well, then we have to at least allow for the potential that it could accelerate higher. And acceleration is a trend ending, but it is also when you make money fastest. And I think that the odds-on potential is that this market will climax in an acceleration. And we are already seeing evidence of some acceleration in some markets. This was a big week for Amazon. It paused in the region of the psychological 1,000 level and then broke above it. And it is closing out the week at $1,006. It has done nothing but go up for 3 months. And on previous occasions, when it has had some of these very impressive advances, then it has had these violent pullbacks towards the moving average. And considering that there is $160 between the price right now and the moving average, that is the potential drawdown. And even if it has that, it would still be in a bull market. So this has been, and the primary consistency characteristic of this trend is that it goes up a lot and has a violent pullback. And it has just gone up a lot. And it is still going up. And in the absence of that first clear downward dynamic, we would have to continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. If it is clearing the 1,000 level, then you're back in blue sky territory above that level. Google has also raced to get to the 1,000 level, and it has not yet stopped. It has paused in the region of 1,000 this week, but this has been a really very impressive advance. Google has got this clear pattern of pausing in the region of big psychological levels, and it is currently at a big psychological level, so we may have an additional pause here. But I think the most important point is that as long as it is trading to the left of the 200-day moving average, I don't think anybody is going to be particularly worried about it. Nvidia might have a lot going for it, not least because it has got a dominant position in the gaming market, in the virtual reality market, and is making inroads into putting graphics chips into cars. So it has done phenomenally well over the last 3 weeks, and it gapped higher on stronger earnings, but it has done so really very, very quickly. Before I started doing the audio, I was looking at Mary Meeker's tech presentation. It's about 300 slides long, so I haven't looked at all of it, but she was making the point that Netflix has been seeing its revenue and its subscriber base growing pretty impressively for the last few years, and its stock is keeping pace. So it is also now getting increasingly overextended. Then, and there are a small number of large cap shares that are doing phenomenally well, and we are about halfway through the year, and they are among the best performers. If we look at the best performing sector within the Nasdaq, then it is some of these household name type companies, where you have Activision Blizzard being the world leader in games. My daughter, for her birthday, wanted Overwatch, and Overwatch has become another best-selling, almost addictive online game. So that is also helping to drive the demand for Nvidia, because Activision Blizzard broke out of a lengthy base in 2012 and really hasn't looked back. But again, this is another share that is really quite overextended relative to the trend mean. And these types of companies and the technology sector is benefiting both from the low interest rate environment, which is making capital available for experimentation in just about every sector. They're benefiting because of the pace of technological innovation, and that is helping to drive interest into this sector. It isn't any longer a question of whether somebody can have, whether someone should invest in technology, but we also have to begin to consider the disruptive influence that some of the technological advances are likely to have, and what kind of impact that's going to have on other parts of the stock market, and most particularly those that have generally been considered to be defensive sectors, and utilities is one of them. the utility sector is going to benefit from advances in tech in battery technology. In fact, I think that advances in battery technology, because they're hinging more on chemistry than on software, it represents the linchpin that is holding together a significant proportion of some of the more enthusiastic forecasts for what the future might look like. But to give one example, what we've seen recently is that utilities have been investing rather a lot of money in batteries, because they have to maintain this redundant supply, most often with coal-fired power stations, to ensure that they have base load, and to be able to ensure they have base load at peak times of demand. And they're replacing some of these coal-fired power stations with large batteries. And that is going to both improve their bottom line, it is going to also smooth out their production profile, which means that the power plants that they hold on to will be more efficient. But so they're doing things to ensure their medium-term survival. But over the longer term, if we get the kinds of improvements in battery technology that are possible, and there's a lot is going to become possible if the energy density of batteries doubles from here. And so far, that energy density has been doubling about every 4.5 years. So we are potentially on the cusp of something very important. If we get batteries doubling, then the range, energy density of batteries doubling, then the range of electric vehicles could also double. And then we get to a point where the argument about range anxiety becomes much less compelling. If we have effective batteries, then the price comes down, and that's when solar really comes into its own. Because right now people produce the electricity and they sell it onto the network, and then they have to take electricity back from the network when the sun is no longer shining. If you had a home battery, you wouldn't have to tap the network. You could simply sell your excess onto the network, and while also charging a battery. That changes the economics completely. It would also change the economics for the industrial sector. And then you also have there has been this big argument about the pace with which new technologies can really come to bear. I think that there, despite the fact that the electricity took 50 years to reach almost full penetration, but that's a physical network. Whereas, mobile phones, you can put a tower in a church steeple and reach thousands of units. So that becomes really very, very cost effective, and it becomes something that can be done really very easily, because you're really only talking about installing small pieces of infrastructure rather than laying cable for an electricity network. But of course, the whole point is that the electricity network already exists. It needs to be upgraded somewhat. We probably need to get a bit smarter, but it already exists. And charging stations are potentially something that could be just hooked up to it in a really rather rapid manner, and that is totally dependent on demand. About a third of all cars in the US are leased, so if the economics of an electric vehicle become compelling, there is the potential that we could have a very quick surge in demand for electric vehicles, and that is potentially not that far off into the future. And I think the other way to think about technology is how technology is designed in one location, in one sector, and then it gets used in others. And oil prices are currently around $50 for Brent crude. They have so far failed to get above $60. There's a reason for that. Despite the fact that OPEC have shaved 2 million barrels of supply off of the global market, they have really only succeeded in getting prices to move up and down. They haven't been able to sustain a move. And part of the reason for that is because of technological innovation. 10 years ago, everyone was worried about peak supply. So there was a massive investment boom, and the major oil companies and the state-owned oil companies spent trillions of dollars on developing new sources of supply and developing new technologies. And we have had really quite profound advances in drilling technology, in seismology, in hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling. And that has resulted in the marginal cost of production coming down over the last 4 or 5 years, and it is probably now about as efficient as it can be. So the offshore shelf for Statoil in Norway is being effectively produced now at around $25 a barrel. Royal Dutch Shell's offshore, deep water offshore, in the pre-salt off Brazil, is coming in at around $40 a barrel. And that means that we have an environment where offshore is cost-effective at today's levels, and that is generally considered one of the most expensive sources of supply. When we look at the futures curve, August 17 is trading at $49.95, and May 19, almost 2 full years, May 19 is trading at $51.35. That would suggest that there is almost no time value to money at all, that there isn't really any premium being put on forward prices. What it also means is that because we have this very tight spread right across the futures curve, it tells us that there is ample demand for a price around this level, that producers are more than willing to hedge at $50 a barrel because they can produce very economically below that level. And that represents a significant challenge for OPEC. And then when we think about it another way, hydraulic fracturing works in impermeable rock, and that is the really great part of the discovery, that it isn't that we didn't know that there was oil in impermeable rock, it's just that nobody knew how to get it out. And geothermal energy has always worked kind of similarly. Most of the geothermal projects around the world are focused on permeable rock basins. They've largely relied on the water from underground flowing up to where it can be accessed. But what is happening with EGS technology, which is enhanced geophysical systems, or geothermal systems, is that they are moving into areas where you have impermeable rock. And part of the reason that they're doing that is that they're employing many of the same techniques that were used for hydraulic fracturing. And they're doing it in impermeable rock because they're going to pump water and sand down the pipe, and there's less chance of losing it in impermeable rock, so that when it comes back up, it is heated. And that represents really quite a profound change. The potential geothermal resource all over the world is more than enough to heat the entire planet 20 times over. And the cost of drilling has come down substantially. Even if you're still talking about drilling an unconventional well and it costs about $4 million, that represents a challenge for startups and utility-type companies, but because their ability to get the money back is going to be slower than it would be for a wildcat oil driller. But the technology is improving all the time, and it means that we could have a potential future where we have cheap, clean, abundant geothermal energy. And That represents perhaps the greatest challenge to the oil market, because it makes the potential for charging for charging batteries or for creating hydrogen, it becomes really very easy. So we are in an environment where there is still this argument about whether we're in a peak demand environment. I personally do not have a great deal of sympathy with peak demand. We have hundreds of years of history where we've seen prices move in up and down cycles, and new uses for commodities evolve when prices come down a lot. So I think it is perhaps better to think about oil prices in terms of the price, but not so much in terms of whether we're going to stop using oil altogether. I think that that is perhaps a just a bridge too far. In fact, if we stop using oil for transportation, then the chances are is that we will be using it for a lot of other different sectors. That the crack in the crude oil is currently driven towards gasoline, but it could be cracked in another way. It could be it could move much more towards plastics or fertilizers. So I don't think that the oil industry is going to evaporate, but there is the potential that a number of the drilling operations could move from being drilling for oil rather than just a drill for geothermal, because there is the that is a clean and abundant, cheap domestic energy source for just about every country on Earth. And I do think that that is where the potential future likely is, and it doesn't suffer from the intermittency that we get in a number of the other technologies. If we have an environment where the central banks are unable to raise interest rates at the speed with which they might like to, and have difficulty reducing the size of their balance sheets because of the deflationary impacts that that might have, then, and we're certainly seeing that the bond market is beginning to price in that eventuality. Well, that's really bullish for our stocks. We looked at the S&P 500 already, but the Nasdaq is really leading on the upside. It does not have this these ranges one above another that are relatively similar sized. The pace of the advance is picking up. It is beginning to accelerate, and it is closing in on this 6,000 level, but there isn't any great deal of evidence that it has paused at significant levels previously, except maybe back in 2010 and 2011. So the first clear downward dynamic is likely to signal a peak of at least short-term significance, but as long as it is pushing higher, we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. There is the potential that the Nasdaq will accelerate, and I think we would have to conclude that it may be beginning to accelerate now. There are a significant number of additional stock markets are breaking on the upside. The FTSE 100 did it just a couple of months ago, and it is currently trading around 7,500, so it is 500 points above the previous peak, and it has now completed a 17-year range. The DAX index in Germany has benefited more from the creation of the euro than just about anywhere else, and it is also benefiting from the ECB's largesse, so it is also breaking up to new high ground. The Nikkei index, and I've been talking, I guess I have a long position, so I've been talking it up for the last few days, but it cleared the 20,000 level this today. And 20,000 has been a very big psychological level for Japan since about 1992. And if it can sustain a move above 20,000, then we would have no other choice than to conclude that we are back in a new bull market scenario. The Taiwanese market this week broke above the psychological 10,000 level for the first time since 1997, and Before that, it was in 1990, was the last time it traded above that level. It also represents a resumption of what has been, I think you it's incorrect to say it's a resumption. It would be the beginning of a new bull market. This has been an index which has been plagued by incredible volatility over the last 20 years, and that might be ending. South Korea, despite the fact that there is an uptick in geopolitical tensions, has also broken up and out of what has been a 7-year range. So these are really powerful moves. There is ample potential that we are in a if we think about the psychological perception stages, we are most certainly now in the acceptance phase, and that is beginning to happen. That we're really only in the beginning of the acceptance phase for some of these markets that have just broken out. But the Nasdaq is accelerating. That we are leaving behind reasonable valuations. We are getting up towards silly valuations, and that would suggest that we are entering the third psychological perception stage, and that is characterized by euphoria. We are getting these kinds of arguments coming out that Amazon really is going to take over the world, that there won't be any retail left at all. In fact, that it is even beginning to open up its own retail locations. And but the problem is that the bigger a company gets, the more sectors that it's dominant in, the greater the risk is of antitrust. So I think Amazon is a fantastic company. It is an incredibly well-run company, and it is making perhaps not profits, but it is certainly turning over a great deal of money. But it cannot go up indefinitely, so it has to be monitored. And then the and we have to simply this is the time to become disciplined with stops. When something is clearly accelerating, that then it is not the time to give in to hype. It is rather the time to become suspicious of hype. So while maintaining a bullish attitude, while thinking, giving it the benefit of the doubt, we also have to consider that these markets are getting hot. And we also have to think about the governance, not only of companies but of the world. There are some very big changes happening. We have been through a period of time where the status quo was really very stable, but what we're seeing increasingly is that populism is on the rise, but not just populism, it's also nationalism. And nationalism has historically been the perhaps might be described as the first and last resort of the tyrant. It is how you can make sure that your population rallies around you when you point their anger at an outside enemy. And North Korea represents a challenge. They seem to be intent on aggravating just about everybody. And the US has sent in a third carrier. So if when you have a third aircraft carrier moving into an area, that generally suggests that they are pretty serious about attempting to try and deter North Korea from any further nuclear tests. And that does represent a potential black swan event. That is the kind of thing that could take the impetus out of the stock market in a dynamic manner. And it would be something that would unwind some short-term overbought conditions in a rapid manner. There is also the point, and actually I should show a number of other markets that are continuing to push on. India continues to benefit both from the relative stability of its currency, but also that the banking sector is pacing this advance in the Nifty, and it is also trading at new highs. So we can also see that it is mostly in Asia where we're getting markets breaking on the upside. And that is despite the fact that when I think people have been worried about protectionism, there is just no evidence that that is a factor in how investors are calculating the potential for additional upside. The Asian region is exhibiting exceptional relative strength right now. It remains one of the most dynamic regions in the world and the home of billions of new consumers. China is going through a political turmoil right now because there are so many vacant positions opening up in the Standing Committee and in the Politburo. And that's likely to represent a source of anxiety for much of the next 4 or 5 months. So, while there is still no evidence that the bull market in stocks has ended, and we do have evidence that it is in fact beginning to accelerate, we know that there are potential threats out there. And that is something that we just have to keep at the back of our minds. It is an additional reason to be disciplined about our participation in the markets. And if we are thinking about hedges, then it's probably worth considering gold. Gold prices have, and I continue to think that the most important thing gold has done has had this massive reaction against that prevailing 5-year downtrend at the beginning of last year, and it is now having this right-hand extension phase or first step above the Type 2 bottom, and it is rallying from the lower side of that range right now. Platinum is testing the region of its moving average, but while there is the potential for prices to advance from here because they are comparatively low relative to where they have traded over the last decade, I think it is important to also remember that the big bull market for commodities is probably over. When we look at the Dow Gold ratio, that was an important low back in 2011, and stocks have outperformed pretty considerably since. And if history is any guide, that is likely to continue well into the lengthy medium term. So I think precious metals are interesting from time to time, but they are unlike, I think they are more trading vehicles today than buy and hold vehicles. I think that's perhaps the most important fact. Whereas I think stocks are buy and hold, but most particularly buy on pullbacks, and we haven't had a pullback in a while. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.